Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. We all know stories of people acting unethically in their business dealings. Take, for example, Enron, a multi-billion dollar energy company that spectacularly failed in 2001 and inspired the documentary, The Smartest Guys in the Room.
Did you convert stock worth $66 million?
I don't know.
I netted approximately $100 million.
Enron is a company that deals with everyone with absolute integrity.
To argue about my compensation, and if I step on somebody's throat on the way, that doubles it. Well, I'll stomp on the guy's throat.
How exactly does Enron make its money?
Accounting doesn't get that creative.
I would like to know if you are on crack.
This is the shredded evidence that came out of Enron.
Everyone was on the bandwagon, and it can happen again.
We are the good guys. We are on the side of angels.
But of course, ethical lapses did not end with Enron about a decade ago. There have been a slew of banking scandals since, most recently Barclays, which has been accused of and fined for manipulating lending rates. Here's business professor Chris Roebuck talking on the BBC about how questionable decisions can lead to other questionable decisions.
People in the banks were under pressure to produce the goods, and some of them stepped over the line. And that's where the problems come, because once you've stepped over the line once, it then becomes easy for the people around you to step over the line with you and for it to become common practice.
So how do we consciously or unconsciously slip from ethical to unethical? To answer that question, I'm joined here in Studio 3 by three people who have looked at ethics and morality in the workplace. Francesca Gino, Associate Professor at Harvard Business School, Max Bazerman, Professor at Harvard Business School, and Iris Bonnet, Academic Dean and Professor of Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks so much for joining us. So, Max Bazerman, let me go to you on that question of Barclays, which we've seen in the news. So, Barclays was fined over $450 million recently, but the investigation has not stopped. The question is, did other banks manipulate the lending rate too so they could profit from it? Is it true that once one person steps over the line, it becomes so much easier to do it again and again?
I think it does. I've conducted experimental work with Francesca Gino on what we call a slippery slope. And a lot of unethical behavior occurs one step at a time. So going over the line one time certainly makes that more common. What's also interesting in these stories is that not only are there a small number of bad people who are acting in inappropriate ways, but there are lots of people who have access to the data, who see what's going wrong and fail to act. So often in the media, we get this impression of these sort of major stories that the critical issue is the bad guy who did the wrong thing. But I think that all of us need to be thinking about the question, do we see these bad behaviors in our organizations and do nothing? And then sort of point the finger only at the bad guy later on. And are we responsible when we don't act, when we have the data to do so?
Well, and I know that you and some of the people that you have done studies with have looked, for example, this is not in the business world, but at the Jerry Sandusky case and Joe Paterno's role in it and other people's role in it. And that same idea of sort of maybe not being the person yourself who did the bad things, but turning away. How common is that?
I think it happens all the time. I think that most of us have been in situations where our organizations have acted in inappropriate ways, where they've acted in sexist and racist ways, where they've developed a pattern of not treating the customer fairly, where they cut corners on how they file taxes. And we go on and on and on. We see it and we don't take it as our responsibility to act on that bad behavior. And from my perspective, we become a culprit in the story when we see egregious behavior and do nothing about it.
Francesca, do you know, when you look at Barclays, when you look at all the banking scandals, do the people who are acting unethically believe themselves to be unethical people?
I think there is a little bit of both going on. So both Max and other colleagues and I have looked for quite some time at the question of why is it that even good people do bad things. And what is interesting is that a lot of times when we see cheating or unethical behavior more broadly in lab settings, but also in the field, we see that a lot of people cheat by a little bit. And it's interesting that they only cheat by a little bit because it seems that that helps them still keep a good image of who they are as people. So they don't need to revise what they think about themselves, and they go on with their lives thinking that they're actually competent and interesting and good people.
Do people also cheat by a little bit because that's what they think they can get away with?
It turns out that our evidence is a little bit against that. So it seems that we all believe that thinking about the risk of being caught is something that people have on their mind as they engage in these behaviors, and the evidence is not supportive of that. So it feels that people have great predictions of the fact that in their lives they're going to be good and ethical people, but when it comes to the time of facing difficult ethical dilemmas, we sort of give in to the temptation and cheat by a little bit. But we're not as focused on this risk of being caught.
Max Baserman, have you seen whole workplace cultures go awry? We certainly saw it with Enron. And the culture bring down people who might otherwise be perfectly good, decent people?
I think we see it in both in organizations, and we even see it in entire industries. So we see situations where auditors have lax standards, and we've created institutional structures where auditors really aren't rewarded for finding what's wrong with their clients' books. And over time, standards become lax, and we allow that to occur. And as a society, we look the other way. So again, I think citizens are responsible, regulators are responsible. In too many situations, bad norms develop and become just accepted on a quite regular basis. For years, steroid use in baseball was accepted. And we point the finger at the player who's been found to use steroids, but we don't think about the baseball teams who encouraged steroid use, who rewarded steroid use, and looked the other way for years and years and years. And then all of a sudden, when the society says there's a problem, the teams look at the players as if they're the bad guys rather than thinking about the norms that were created both in the organization and in the broader industry.
Right. And with steroids in baseball, it feels like we've come to a point now, or at least in the past few years, where, you know, if you didn't take steroids, it was very hard to play the game.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if everybody else is engaging in unethical behavior, it's awfully tough to compete.
Yeah, you develop a new norm of cheating. We're talking about ethics and morality and business. I'm Kara Miller, and I'm talking with Francesca Gino and Max Baserman from Harvard Business School, and Iris Bonnet, academic dean and professor of public policy at Harvard Kennedy School. And I want to come back to this issue of new norms. Are we not cracking down enough on unethical behavior in business? I'm going to play a little clip for you of New York Times financial columnist James Stewart, who was talking just the other day about what Barclays did in manipulating this lending rate and how he thinks we just have not nearly cracked down enough.
You look at these facts, which is, like, to me, an open and shut case of criminal activity at a corporate level, corporate crime, and the guidelines for charging a corporation. And so I'm wondering, well, why didn't they have to plead guilty to a crime? And I have to conclude that part of the answer is that just like some banks are too big to fail, some banks are too big to indict. And when you think about it, that really pulls the rug out from the whole criminal system, because one of the main points of criminal prosecution of corporations is deterrence. So you wonder why all this stuff keeps happening, and then you look back and you see, well, none of these companies are being held accountable for it.
Francesca Gino, is this like steroids in baseball, where we're like, you know what, the new norm is that banks sort of manipulate the rules, so we'll give them a fine, but, you know, they're multi-billion dollar firm. If it's a $400 million fine, it's a little bit like pocket change for them. And so are we just not cracking down enough?
Yeah, I think, as Max was saying, there are a lot of examples across many different organizations. And for the last couple of years, we've been focusing a lot on banking. But I often talk to students in my class who spend a lot of time in consulting, and you see the exact same type of behaviors where it's becoming a norm, an okay thing to do, to not be completely straightforward or transparent with your clients. Or the same thing happens in real estate or many, many other industries. So I think that what this tells us is the importance of reflecting on the first steps or transgressions that we see in organizations and really trying to stop those and making interventions, because otherwise, very soon, through the slippery slope that Max was talking about, it's going to become accepted behavior.
Is your sense that it's getting worse? That we used to live in a sort of more moral business culture 15, 20 years ago?
There is quite a bit written on that. There is a beautiful book called The Cheating Culture that argues that there are actually not that many differences across the time. I think that now we have better ways to learn about these cases. So we hear and read about a lot of cases across industries of corporate corruptions and unethical behavior. But it seems like it's been with us as a problem for quite some time.
Max Baserman, does it feel to you like we're getting more corrupt, like the norm of cheating a little bit on the margins is becoming accepted?
So I agree with Francesca. It's hard to tell because the media is better at finding out when things go wrong in organizations. But I do think that there are some examples, and it probably varies industry by industry, where the businesses that we've allowed banks to be involved in has a significant influence on the ethicality of their actions. So I think that there are a variety of policy differences that affect different industries in different ways. So in some industries, I think that our standards have become weaker. But in other industries, I wouldn't make that claim.
Do you think it's at all because there's a lot of pressure on companies to come up with quarterly profits, to report on things all the time, rather than sort of taking their time and saying, well, we're going to make an investment. Maybe it won't work out this year, but...
Sure. And a lot has been written about investment banks that used to be privately owned. Private ownership tends to lead to a longer-term perspective. Being publicly traded leads to a much shorter-term perspective. Shorter-term perspectives increase the propensity to cheat at the margin.
And Iris Bonet, you've looked at ethics in hiring people, in sort of promoting them. And I would venture to say that I and everyone listening believes themselves to be fundamentally fair people. People who would sort of focus on what really matters about a job candidate rather than be distracted by appearances or by small details.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, it literally is people like you and me and everyone else in this room and everyone who's listening to the program right now who think of themselves as good people and well-meaning people, well-intentioned people. But we sometimes call this the intention-action gap. It's actually not so easy to follow through on your intentions, in particular because we're not always aware of the issues that we bring to the table. So one example is that we tend to associate certain behaviors with certain types of peoples or certain professions or certain tasks with certain types of people. And so take the example of women and men. If we have few women in leadership positions, think CEOs or women on boards or women in parliament, women in government, if we have few women in those roles, we don't tend to think of leadership as something that goes together with women.
So do we think leadership looks male?
Yes, we do think leadership
okay.
looks male.
And are there other qualities that we attach to what a leader looks like?
Yeah, I mean, a leader is an assertive person, is a self-confident person, sometimes even a risk taker. And these are all not attributes which we normally associate with women. You know, we have these stereotypes in our heads, and that's why we find it hard to evaluate people objectively.
So in your experiment, how did you measure stereotypes that people had?
So we took two gender stereotypic tasks. So we looked for tasks where most people would think men are better at X, so women are better at Y. So the tasks that we took were a math task, where most people think that men are better at math, although recent evidence suggests that that's no longer true. And then we also took a verbal task, where most people would think that women are better at verbal tasks. And we had other people, which played the role of employers, choose someone who had to perform either a math task or a verbal task for them. And these employers were paid based on these employees' performance. That's always very important in experiments, that you want to mimic real life and create real incentives so that people actually are motivated to take this very seriously and choose the person who they believe is the best performer.
Did they have any sense of whether these women who they could be hiring or the men who they could be hiring were actually good at math?
Right.
I mean, did they have any sense of how talented they really were? Did they just see men and women?
Yeah, that's a super important question. And often, of course, a question that is harder to answer in real life, where you have a CV and maybe, you know, previous credentials, but it's hard to really judge a person's quality. So we wanted to design an experiment where we could provide people with very, very strong and clear information on the quality of an applicant. And so what we did is we had these applicants perform the math task first, and they did it twice. So they did the same task. They had to add up two-digit numbers or something very easy. And let's assume you, Kara, you are the employer. We told you how many problems these candidates solved correctly in the first round. So you knew exactly how well these people did.
So also had everybody's test scores.
That's exactly right. So you knew exactly how well these people performed. And then you could hire them for the same task that they would have to perform in the future. And so you knew exactly how well they did on this very task. And you were asked, do you want to hire this person or not? And you will be paid based on that person's performance. And what we found was is that if you see only one candidate at a time and have to decide, do I want to hire him or her now? Or do I want to go back to the pool and someone else is going to just be assigned to me randomly, pure luck? People base their decisions very much on stereotypes. So they will be much more likely to choose a woman for the verbal task than a man. And they're also much more likely to choose the man for the math task than the woman.
Even if they knew the woman had done just as well on the math test.
Even if women had done better in the math test.
Even if they had done better.
That
interesting.
Is very painful.
So I actually want to play a little bit of sound for you from Stu Coleman, who is the general manager at Winter Wyman, which is a really large staffing firm in New England and New York. And he's talking here a little bit about when people are looking for temporary employees, how gender biases surface.
People flat out said, you know, I need to find a nice young girl that would do this job for us. And we will all instantly ask, okay, help us understand why A, young, and B, girl. And the answers are never have anything to do with anything other than they thought that would be the best person for the role. And often it's, well, you really want somebody who's done this before, correct? Yeah, and it's comfortable in that environment, right? So in the end, it doesn't really matter. Well, I guess not. But people are people, you know, and they have these natural biases in their heads.
Iris Bonet, there it is, like the sort of natural bias where they say, yeah, I need a young female secretary. And they have to come back and say, I'm sorry, is there a reason that a woman has to be your secretary?
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful example. And, of course, also shows why it's so hard to learn from our mistakes because we don't even know we're making them and we don't even know we're using these stereotypes as basis of our decisions.
So, Max Bazerman, I want to come back to you. And in part, what we've been talking about is people sort of overestimating their own ability to make really quality decisions. And I wonder, do you think that's part of the problem that we see in businesses, that people overestimate, I can make this trade and there's not going to be any negative consequences? They overestimate their own power.
Exactly. So we're biased and we don't know that we're biased. And there's been a lot of work in the field of behavioral decision research to try to figure out how to unbias the human mind. And that's a field that I've been connected to for a long time. And my overall assessment is that we've largely failed in figuring out how to debias the human mind. But a couple of years ago, Dick Thaler and Cass Sunstein wrote a book called Nudge. And a core theme of Nudge is that what we might need to do is accept how the mind works. And going back to some of your early questions, Kara, to think about how can we design organizations so that they are less likely to lead humans to be biased. So in the experiment that Iris was describing, we see massive discrimination in favor of men for math and women for verbal problems. But when we create a new condition where people are evaluating the same employees, but this time they see two different employees at the same time. And it's for the math task, and we get to pick between a female and a male, and the female performs slightly better than the male. Now all of a sudden, we don't discriminate the way we did when we were looking at one candidate at a time. When we can see the clear performance difference, we realize we're not supposed to act on gender. And we take the female who performed more highly on stage one to perform for us at stage two over the male who was slightly worse. And so what we try to do in that experiment is to create an ethical nudge that has relevance in the real world. So we would strongly recommend that human resource professionals avoid evaluating candidates one at a time, because when we evaluate candidates one at a time, we're going to see far more discrimination than if we compare two or more candidates at the same time.
Well, there's also fascinating research, I know, that looks at when you have a person in a position of responsibility, like, let's say, a judge. By the end of the day, they're making decisions based on what they did earlier in the day. So if they feel like they've been really hard on criminals that day, the criminal who they sentence last in the day is likely to have an easy time and get off easy, because they feel like, yeah, I've been hard on a lot of people today, so I'm going to let the – you know, so people take things out of context.
And I think one of the nudges that it would apply in that context but would apply in many organizations is that the judge should take a look at the data. The judge should look at what the sentences look like at different times of the day, based on different sequences, based on the ethnicity of the person that's being sentenced. And by looking at the decisions that we've made, we can often see biases that aren't apparent to us on an intuitive basis.
Francesca Gino, I believe you looked at admissions officers, right? And the kinds of decisions that they're making with their candidates by the end of the day versus what they do at the beginning of the day. What happens there?
Yeah, it's another example where the sequence seems to matter. And in this case, because of the design of the interviews, this was data from people being admitted to MBA programs. Because of the way the interviews are designed, you're going to be doing interviews one at a time. And just the fact that we have a set of interviews happening in a day affects the way we make judgments during that day. And we sort of assume that we have a sense of the number of people that we are going to admit and a sense of the distribution of our evaluation during that particular recruiting season. And we apply that to the set of judgment that we're making that particular day.
Right. And we think we know, like, this is what it takes to get into Yale. Like, we think we know it's an absolute and we can just carry that information with us anywhere we go. Right.
Exactly.
But it's not necessarily true.
Exactly. So what I think is important about the research is that it tells us about the fact that creating, even in this case, the set is the day. We sort of use that as a bracket for making our judgments, and a lot of bias comes into that, even when those sets are completely random.
So what kinds of choices were people making by the end of the day that they may not have made at the beginning of the day?
In this case, they were evaluating candidates based on interviews, and so there were judgments related to how well they're going to do, they would be doing in the program, whether they would be great team players. And so if you've been a little bit nicer during the day and you gave higher ratings to people that you saw earlier in the day, you're going to be unnecessarily and unfairly harsh on people that you see later the same day, even when they have qualifications that might be better to previous candidates.
So that person who gets interviewed last in the day for the MBA program or for college or whatever it is might just get really unlucky. They're really good, but if they had been second versus 10th, they might have been better off.
Exactly. If the admission officer was nice and less stringent earlier on in the day, that's exactly the pattern of results that you would see. And it's totally outside the control of the specific candidate, and it's quite unfair.
Iris Bonnet, we talked about, obviously, that kind of bias and discrimination in the workplace. How do you fix it? And can you implement this in real life?
No, absolutely. I mean, we are very hopeful that many organizations will rethink how they hire and particular how they promote, because many promotion decisions, in fact, are done as one-offs. I mean, you might have an outside offer and then I have to evaluate that particular person. How can we increase the likelihood that the person will stay? And you kind of have to respond. And what we're trying to argue is to move as many decisions as we possibly can into group contexts where you make more than one promotion or hiring decision at a time. I'd also like to point out that often we think ethics and profits kind of work against each other and you can't have both. But in case of discrimination, we would strongly argue that you actually as a company are interested in the best. And you should have an interest from a profit maximizing point of view as well to overcome these biases. So it's both ethically the right decision, but it is also business-wise the smart decision to try to overcome biases and change hiring and promotion practices.
Max Baserman from Harvard Business School. Let me ask you a question on a slightly different topic. If people aren't that good at evaluating candidates in isolation, as Iris Bonnet points out, how good are they at evaluating themselves? I actually spoke recently on Innovation Hub to author and psychologist Chris Chabry, who has looked at people's tendency to evaluate themselves in not quite an accurate way. Here's a little clip from that conversation.
The typical result when people have surveyed the public on questions like, are you more intelligent than the average person? Are you a better driver than the average person? And so on. Even, professors were surveyed and asked, are you better than the average professor? I believe in that case, 94% said yes, which is even more than the number of people who say they're better than average in intelligence, which is maybe more like 70 or so. Yeah, that can't be true, right? So some of those 70% have got to be, actually in the bottom 50%. And we can quibble over what average means and so on. But no matter how you slice it, for most of these kinds of traits, people seem to be a little bit overconfident in their own abilities.
Max Baserman, this is the idea of teaching people that really a lot of people are confident and you're not alone here.
Yeah, the tendency to overestimate our skills is greater the more ambiguous the domain. And the question, how ethical are you, is pretty ambiguous. The question of how nicely do you treat the environment is a pretty ambiguous question. And to the extent that we can get people to focus on their behaviors, like do you ever leave the lights on when you leave your house? Do you turn the thermostat down? If you get people to think about specific behaviors, they often become more aware of the person that they actually are. But to the extent that you keep the question on these meta vague questions, then we see tremendous overestimation of who we are.
And Francesca Gino, we see whole sort of industries, take for example real estate, which I know you've looked into, where people tend not to be 100% honest about what's going on, what the truth is about the house that they want to sell, because they have a real investment in it. And there's this kind of self-justification of, that's okay, everybody does it.
Exactly. There is quite a bit of focus on what the outcome of our actions is. And as a society, but also as organization, as individuals, we tend to focus on that in order to understand whether our behavior is good versus not. So in research with Max and also Don Moore, a colleague at the University of Berkeley in California, we have looked at situations where you get to observe actions of others or also your own, and the actions per se could be shady, but then the outcome is good. So, for example, in real estate, you might be selling a house and put it on the market and know that there are problems with it. But if the problem never emerges later, then we're good, moral, our actions didn't have any issue. But then if the problem instead emerges, then we go back and check whether our actions were actually problematic to start with. And I think it's striking to see, again, as individuals and as organizations and industry, how much we tend to focus on outcomes rather than the process that led us to those outcomes.
So you're saying if the basement tends to flood in your house and you don't tell anybody that, and then there's a huge deluge and the new buyers are in huge trouble, they're out a lot of money, you're judged as worse than if you have a leaky basement, you don't tell anybody, and you get really lucky and there's a drought.
Exactly. And again, there are lots of examples in organizations that are very similar to that. In a lot of promotion discussions, decisions, we tend to look at whether the employees or the employers or the managers reached the goals that they were set out to reach for themselves. And we never ask a lot of questions about what was the process that actually led them to reach those goals.
So, Max Baserman, do companies work with you at all and say, can you come in and teach us how to be more effective in making decisions so that we're not sort of relying on our own belief in our abilities?
Increasingly so. All three of us also work in the area of decision making and negotiation. And historically, there's been a much greater interest in improving how we negotiate than how we can behave more ethically. But shows like this one and the increased media attention on ethics are increasing the degree to which organizations are interested in dealing with some of the fundamental ethical issues that they confront.
Is there a bottom line component to making ethical decisions?
Yes, and I think Iris highlighted that very nicely when she basically said, you want the most effective employee. And to the extent that you're taking the second or third best because of your propensity to discriminate, then you're not making a good decision for your organization.
You know, people should also think of choosing a pair of shoes. If they buy shoes, they rarely only look at one pair. Because if you only look at one pair, how easy is it to make an informed judgment? But if you look at 10 pairs, you compare and you try them on, you compare price, color, everything, you just going to make a smarter choice. So I think it's this intuition which guides our work and also in organizations. So hopefully we can come back in a few years and tell you more about how this is really working out in organizations.
Iris Bonnet from Harvard's Kennedy School and Francesca Gino and Max Bazerman from Harvard Business School, thank you so much for joining us. And you can learn more about our guests on our website, wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can link to our free iTunes podcast. Coming up next, Building a Greener City. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.